It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new investigative report found ethical irregularities in travel to Turkey by members of Congress. The trips were paid for by a network of Turkish religious organizations.
But first, it's our Wisconsin News Roundup.
Some new numbers came out this week covering Wisconsin students' test scores, graduation rates, and voucher school enrollment. And the state assembly was busy this week as they passed civil service reforms and two other high-profile bills.
Robert Menser is with us. He's the storytelling editor for the Wausau Daily Herald and Gannett Central Wisconsin Media. Robert, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Veronica. Thanks for having me back.
Well, first up, a national report card came out for student test scores in math and reading for all 50 states. How did Wisconsin stack up?
So, not bad. A big new trove of student testing data. The National Assessment of Educational Progress, the last time that the big national test was given was 2013. Wisconsin is pretty stable on the scores. This test measures fourth graders and eighth graders on math and reading. So it's a sampling, and it's always sort of hard to know exactly how much weight to put on these sorts of data anyway. But the headline is, in math, Wisconsin students exceeded the national average. For eighth grade math, students were seventh in the nation. Eighth grade reading, ninth in the nation. Fourth grade reading didn't look as good, but was fairly stable. There were 25th in the nation for fourth grade reading, and 17th in the nation for fourth grade math.
And also this week we learned that enrollment in the state's voucher program grew quite a bit compared to last year. What are the numbers on that?
Sure. So this is what you would expect to happen as the policy was changed to open the voucher enrollments. So they more than doubled the overall Wisconsin vouchers to about 2,500 students this year, according to a release from the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. There's a separate program in Racine that rose by 23% to another 2,127 students. This is the growth as a result of the changes to the cap of those programs.
Any projections about what the numbers could look like next year, or do you expect to see this trend continuing?
So obviously vouchers are a controversial issue and a sort of a partisan issue, but to a lot of lawmakers, this is good news, and they want to see the trend continue. The argument against, or an argument against, is that also according to the Department of Public Instruction, the 142 districts that were affected by the program are going to lose $11.9 million in state aid as a result of as a result of losing these students. They're going to end up, in many cases, raising their levies for local property taxes, and so it may be reflected in tax bills. That's something that could change the trend, right?
And we're going to switch gears now. We're going to talk about the state assembly. They had a busy week. They passed a number of bills, including civil service reforms. How did that vote in the assembly go this week?
Yeah, so party line vote. The civil service overhaul is... has been the subject of some controversy. The idea is to, advocates say, to make it easier to hire and fire. It would take away the civil service exam and replace that with resumes. This bill is sort of an interesting thing for all the things that the bill does. There's a conflict between the Assembly and Senate over whether or not people who apply for state jobs should have to check a box stating whether they've been convicted of a crime or not. And that the key assembly sponsor says that's going to hold the bill up until probably early 2016 before they will figure out what to do about that.
Really, 2016? So
that's what he said. He does not expect it to pass this fall. We'll see.
Well, okay, so if that one doesn't pass, there's a lot more that could happen quicker. One of these, the Assembly also approved a constitutional amendment. Well, this may not be quicker because it's a constitutional amendment, actually.
But it's going to take a while. Yeah,
right, yeah, that's a process, right? That would eliminate the state treasurer's office. The Assembly voted to approve that measure. What's their reasoning?
Yeah, the beleaguered state treasurer's office, who has no staff and no duties, and whose occupant right now believes that the office should be eliminated. So this has been a long, this is just sort of a vestigial tail of Wisconsin government, and they've taken away all the duties from it. So it's really just a matter of making it official. But I think it's going to take until I think it's 2019 before they'll have to jump through all the hoops to actually eliminate it.
And what would have to happen? You run that to run us through how that process works. The constitutional amendment.
Yeah, so you have to pass it in two concurrent. You have to pass it in the Assembly and the Senate in two separate legislative sessions. So 2 years, and then there has to be a vote on it.
So that was just this week in the Assembly. It was a very busy week. Yeah. Do you see anything else exciting happening next week or in the near future in the Assembly? Or
well, we got to talk about the concealed knives. The
right.
The other thing the Assembly did was overturn an old law prohibiting switchblades and making it legal to carry knives around in your pocket if you want to. That's feels like with concealed carry of handguns, that law maybe is that's not the one that we're going to get upset with. But you know what? Some people did get upset. So.
And what are the next pieces of action for these bits of legislation? At least the switchblade law that you were talking about.
Yeah, so this is Assembly action. This is a heavy week in the Assembly, and so there is sometimes it's hard to know which things are going to be taken up by the Senate and how long it will take. Right, there's always that process. It has to be passed in the Senate. It has to be reconciled. And it's not uncommon to see the Assembly, which is more heavily Republican, stronger Republican majority. It's not uncommon to see them pass bills that end up being moderated or just sort of left to die in committee. I don't know. I mean, the civil service bill, it sounds like it's going to go through a process here, and so I don't know that I would bet against it, but that's the process, and that's often what happens.
We're talking to Robert Menser right now for Wisconsin News Roundup. He's with the Wausau Daily Herald, and we're going to wrap up talking about Planned Parenthood in Appleton announcing that they'll no longer perform abortions at the Appleton Clinic. Now, what's happening there with that news?
So Planned Parenthood in Appleton has suspended abortion services for 6 months is the announcement. The organization is clear that this is temporary and due to a temporary gap in medical coverage, so it's staffing. But at the same time, there are only three clinics in Wisconsin that provide abortions. There's Madison, Milwaukee, and Appleton. And so among abortion rights advocates, this is seen as something that could cause a hardship. And among anti-abortion activists, it's seen as an absolute victory. This same clinic was the site of protests just a few months ago for around the time of those hidden videos. The messages from Planned Parenthood have been clear that this is more of a staffing issue. They're not moving the health center. They're not planning to cancel these services, and it's not related to specific legislation. It still comes at a time when this is a highly charged issue, and it's still seen as either a victory or a setback, depending on your side.
Has Planned Parenthood in Appleton said anything about why there is this gap in coverage? Is there any indication that it is a result of political pressure?
Well, see, this is to the extent that they have spoken about this, which is limited, they deny that, or they don't say that. But it's a bit hard to believe that there wouldn't be an impact on that. I don't know the specific data, and that's something that would be interesting to look into. How many sort of medical students go into this field, or whether this is a more generalized phenomenon than just in sort of northeastern Wisconsin. But it's hard to believe, just using sort of common sense, it's hard to believe that the fact that this is a profession that a lot of people hate and believe is wrong, and in some extreme cases can put you at risk, it's hard to believe that that has no effect, right?
Well, Robert, we'll leave it there. We'll see how that plays out in Appleton and beyond. Robert, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Robert Menser, the storytelling editor for the Wausau Daily Herald and Gannett Central Wisconsin Media. He joined us to recap some of the biggest stories from around the state this week for our Wisconsin News Roundup. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
There are strict regulations about who can pay for trips by members of Congress and their staff members and how they have to be approved and reported. A new investigative report from USA Today raises questions about who funded more than 200 trips to Turkey made by congressional delegations since 2008.
Joining us now is one of the authors of that investigative report, Paul Singer. He's a Washington correspondent for USA Today. Paul, welcome back.
Thank you, Rob. Nice to be on the show.
Well, let's take this one step at a time. First, who's going to Turkey? What kind of trips are we talking about here?
These are trips for about two dozen members of Congress, about 175 or 80 staff members over a period of 6 or 7 years. They're going on these six-day tours of Turkey. They go to visit with public officials there. They go to visit with newspapers there. They go to visit, you know, see some of the lovely antiquities of Turkey. And then they come home, and it's all paid for and reported to Congress as being paid for by a series of about a dozen nonprofit groups. The trouble is, we believe those are not the groups that actually paid for it.
Yeah, now tell us about the groups. And this is where it gets a little complicated.
Yes.
What groups are we talking about, and where do they all tie back to?
Well, they are all they report themselves as independent nonprofit organizations working on Turkish culture and intercultural communication and stuff like that. But they are all linked to what is called the Gulen movement. The Gulen movement is the followers of an intellectual Islamic scholar named Fethullah Gulen, who has actually lived in rural Pennsylvania for about 20 years. He's left Turkey, and at the moment, actually, the Turkish government is asking us to extradite him because he's sort of an enemy of the current state.
And these groups that are on paper funding it, I mean, if a nonprofit group meeting certain criteria wants to fund a congressional junket or trip or whatever you want to call it, that can be okay, as I understand it. What's going wrong? Why are these ethical violations, as you've reported it?
These Gulen groups have been reporting that they took these members of Congress to Turkey and they paid for it themselves. All fine. The only problem is we have learned through investigation that they are not paying it for them from themselves. They, in some cases, they have admitted to investigators on Capitol Hill that there was another organization in Turkey that was paying for significant portions. In some cases, we have discovered that the organizations themselves didn't appear to have any real funding. Some of the organizations didn't actually have 501c3 status, that is, you know, IRS tax-exempt charity status in the United States. So we don't know who the organizations are. We don't know where the money is coming from. We don't know who ultimately paid for these trips. What we do know is that all of these organizations are connected through the Gulen movement, and that many of the people who were being visited in Turkey, that is, many of the hosts in Turkey, were also connected to the Gulen movement, which is not only a religious and ideological music, but a broad political movement as well.
So there's an ethical procedure, as we mentioned, to control how these trips work. Who's supposed to be watching this? Who's minding the shop here?
So I am not going to blame anybody here yet. My story has not yet gotten that far. The members of Congress and their staff who took these trips have responded to us the same way, pretty much line by line, which is the House Ethics Committee approved these trips. And therefore, we took these trips. We submitted all the proper paperwork. It's not our fault if there was something wrong. The Ethics Committee is supposed to investigate these things and tell us. And the Ethics Committee doesn't comment on this stuff other than in an investigation that was done recently, there was some the Ethics Committee reported on this topic, and they said that they had done all of their due diligence. It's not their fault if somebody else lied to them. That is, the organizers of these trips lied about who was actually paying for it. The Ethics Committee has referred some of this information to the Justice Department for the possibility of prosecuting people for lying on these forms, because the form says, I hereby swear that I'm the guy paying for this trip.
Well, let's get to those groups now. You reached out to some of the groups that paid for or filled out paperwork claiming that they paid for these trips to Turkey. Did you hear anything back? And if so, what?
No, I heard nothing back. I reached out to 20-some-odd groups. One of them, there's a cluster of these groups. Part of the issue here is, Rob, is that this is like It's shells. It's overlapping shells of organizations that don't have any employees, any paid employees. They have many of the same directors, volunteer directors. They have many of the same staff. One place is in Washington, D.C. There's three or four groups in the same place. I finally just went over and walked into their office, and there were people there, and I asked if anyone could talk to me, and they said, no, they're all in a meeting, and I gave them my business card, and they never called back. Several of these organizations link. There's like a whole network of them, and I kept calling up and down the chain trying to see if I could find who was really in charge, and I got nowhere. I got no responses, nothing.
Talking to Paul Singer from USA Today about an investigative report on congressional trips to Turkey, funded apparently not by the groups that filled out the paperwork, apparently an ethical violation somewhere along the chain here. Let's talk about this Gulenist movement. Why would they want to curry favor with members of Congress by funding these trips?
Well, let me tell you two things about that. The first is fairly obvious, I think, on the surface, which is at the moment there is an election going on in Turkey this weekend, and the government is actually cracking down on opposition, including the Gulen opposition. There are Gulen newspapers, there are Gulen institutions, and there's been a falling out between the government and the Gulen movement, and the government thinks the Gulen movement is basically trying to destabilize the Turkish government. That being the case, it's very nice for the Gulens to have friends in high places in Washington. At one point earlier this year, a bunch of members of Congress wrote a letter to John Kerry, the Secretary of State, saying you need to talk to the Erdogan government in Turkey about not punishing Gulen journalists. Well, if you look at the signatures on those letters, a lot of the people who signed that letter, members of Congress who signed that letter, had either been to Turkey on a Gulen-funded trip or had sent their staff to Turkey on a Gulen-funded trip. So you're making friends. The other thing to note, Rob, is that this organization or this network pays not only for travel in Congress, but in state legislatures and amongst local elected officials and amongst public sort of persona all across the country. So there's a group in Chicago called the Niagara Foundation, which is a very well known, and they do a lot of good charitable work. And they have a chapter in Wisconsin. I know that they've taken Wisconsin legislators to Turkey, which again, may be fine. I don't know what they tell the Wisconsin legislature. I don't know what the rules are for who can pay for travel in Wisconsin. If it was a congressperson, it would be a problem, but they haven't taken any members of Congress that we know of from Wisconsin. But I do know that this network operates in hundreds of communities around the country.
Bigger picture, and you look at this stuff a lot, these ethical rules in Congress. Is this common for groups affiliated with foreign interests around the world to take congressional representatives and their staff on trips around the world?
Yes and no. There are, for starters, Turkey is a very popular place for people to travel in Congress. It's a fun destination. And there's several organizations, regular sort of above board nonprofits that pay for trips to Turkey by members of Congress fairly regularly. There's sort of the Turkish American Chamber of Commerce kind of groups. There are also organizations. The biggest visiting destination is Israel. There is a nonprofit organization that is affiliated with the Israeli lobby, AIPAC, here in Washington. They pay for lots and lots of travel to Israel. And then there's a smattering of other places that are regularly visited. And there's a bunch of groups that take members of Congress on foreign trips. It's not all that uncommon. There's a group called the Aspen Institute, a very well-known think tank. They take members of Congress all over the place, including to Turkey. The trick is that with all those trips, they're disclosed fully, and we have pretty good confidence that the money is coming from where they say it's coming from. The thing that's so surprising about this is it looks like widespread, I don't know what else to call it, but deceit in an attempt to undermine the disclosure process, and it's worked. I mean, they have gotten away with this for 6 years at least, and we don't know how many other trips this might affect.
Paul, you said you're not ready to blame anybody, keyword, yet. So what's the next step in your investigation here?
Well, I think the fair question to ask is how the Ethics Committee failed to find what we found. Is it because they were simply lied to and the information was not available to them? Is it that they did not do a thoroughgoing review of these trips before they approved them? Remember, all of these trips were approved in advance. If you want to go to Turkey, you have to turn over some documentation to the Ethics Committee and say, hey, can I take this trip? And the committee has to look at it and say, yeah, this looks legit. Go ahead. Our question has to be, one, should the member of Congress have known better that this group looks screwy? Two, should the Ethics Committee have taken a better look and said, Congressman, you don't want to take this trip? And three, if everybody else did what was above board, how did these folks manage to lie their way through the system so easily for so long?
And you'll be covering this in the weeks to come?
Oh, yeah. My suspicion, Rob, is this is going to go on for a while. I mean, there is so much more information related. And again, the Gulen movement runs about 100 and some odd charter schools across the United States. They're involved in a number of organizations, nonprofits, a lot of public activity. We now have to go back and look and see, are there other issues about the way the Gulens have financed their public activities, not only in Congress, but everywhere else? This is going to be a long dig.
Paul, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rob, and happy Halloween.
To you, too. That's Paul Singer, Washington correspondent for USA Today, talking about his new investigative report on ethically questionable trips to Turkey by members of Congress.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
Jan Walker was a community college instructor in Washington State when she was asked to take up a new post teaching family and parenting skills at a federal prison. She agreed to do it for 1 year.
She went on to teach in men's and women's prisons for 18 years and continued to volunteer after retirement. In a new book, she shares her experiences and makes a case for the value of education to help inmates make a successful transition to life outside of prison.
Jan Walker is with us now. Her new book is Unlocking Minds in Lockup. Prison Education Opens Doors. Jan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, what happened to make you change your mind and stay with prison education programs for 18 years, not just one?
Well, when I went inside, first of all, it was actually state prisons where I taught, but my first experience going inside was a federal prison, and that was rather discouraging. But when I went into the women's prison, a state prison in Washington, and saw the need of those women, I found it impossible to quit after a year, regardless of my own interests at the time. Their needs were great enough that I felt I had been sent there by some power beyond my own.
A lot of what you taught had to do with parenting skills. How common is it for inmates to be parents?
Well, a large percentage of them are parents, probably about 75% overall. With women, it's even higher than that. And most of those women are younger women, so they have children that are minor ages and ranging from newborns. There are a number of children born in prison every year. I don't know if you knew that, but they range from infancy then up through the years. And at the time I started teaching inside, the prison programs were very much based on programs offered by community college to parents who could participate on a daily basis. Of course, that wasn't possible for women who are incarcerated. So that's why I got interested in working on developing materials to meet their needs.
Now, when I think of prison education, what pops into mind is, you know, trades, job skills, maybe high school equivalency, college. Why is it important to have these kind of programs in things like family, parenting, social skills?
The first place that most of the people who leave prison are going to go is back to their family. They need somewhere to a light where they can have daily care. Most states and federal prisons release inmates with a very small amount of money. At one time, I think it was $40 gate money in the state of Washington. So an offender had $40 to release and find his way or her way back into the world. And so family has long been stated as probably the most important factor in how former felon is going to reintegrate in society. They need that support desperately.
One huge question that inmates who are parents face is how to explain their situation to their children. What kind of advice, what kind of training did you give inmates and how to do that?
Well, it was interesting that a lot of them told fantastic stories. They could have been novelists about where they were and why. And, of course, then what happens is it closes any roots of communication between the inmate parent and family or children. And so I started them looking at making a very simple statement about what prison is about. So their explanation would simply start with, I broke an adult rule, or I broke an adult crime, or I broke a crime if the child is old enough to understand that. Second sentence, simply, prison is my consequence, or jail is my consequence, and then always end that with saying to the child that it's not the child's fault, because children tend to blame themselves when a parent is suddenly absent from their lives.
But the key there, it sounds like, is not a euphemism, not a story to protect the child from the reality, having an age-appropriate but real explanation.
Absolutely, because children often figure it out. They know. They overhear discussions in the household where they're being reared, and that isn't going to matter whether it's grandparents or an auntie taking care of the children. It happens also in foster care. Someone says something about mom or dad, the parent being in prison, and children start putting it together. So it's always best to start out by talking to them as honestly as possible. And it's not easy for the inmate parent, but once they get the knack of it, it makes a huge difference.
Talking to Jan Walker, she spent 18 years working as an instructor in prisons in Washington State, has volunteered in that capacity since her retirement as well. Her new book is Unlocking Minds in Lockup. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Jan, where do you start with a parent who's in prison, training them in those family skills that they're going to need when they leave?
Well, the interesting thing I learned almost immediately is one of the things they needed was a sense of the law, the legal matters pertaining to parenting and to all domestic or family relationships in their state. Because when they're away from their children, someone needs to be caring for the children. And we have federal and state laws that provide funding and provisions for health care and for other needs that children will have. And before they could really begin to work on their own parenting skills and how they might do better with their children from a distance and also when they return, was to have a clear idea of the law. And so I made that part of the coursework.
And one question that comes up is, in many cases, a child might not know this parent well or at all. If they were born, as you say, in prison, they may have had little or no contact with a parent. And you write about teaching some of the inmates how to reach out and introduce themselves to their kids. How do they do that?
Well, if the child has at least an awareness that there is a parent that is not in the home where they're growing up, the parent just needs to start writing simple letters based on the child's level of understanding, and also one must keep in mind with permission of the persons who are caring for the child, because if there's conflict between the incarcerated parent and the caregivers, the information will not get to the child. It's simply starting to tell stories. I believe very much in the power of story, and if a mom or dad who's incarcerated can begin writing a little bit about their memories of what they were doing when the child was born or when the child was being expected, or if they did have any very early interaction before the child's memory, which could not happen much before age three, they might have an inkling of but not really remember a parent. And storytelling that hooks or connects the child and parent is a positive way for the parent to begin.
And bigger picture, Jan, you went in and you write this not really understanding how prison worked, what life was like in there. How did your experience over the years change your idea about incarcerated people?
Well, it didn't take long for me to realize that it's humanity in a microcosm, that the people I worked with became students when they walked into a classroom inside prison. And I think probably most people who teach inside prisons would tell you the same, that once an incarcerated person can leave the general population long enough to go into a classroom, they can find their own humanity. They have a better opportunity to function as a person in their own right rather than as someone having to uphold any image they might have developed as being a con or being tough or being part of a gang. When I saw that, when I saw that these people look just like my own children, perhaps, or neighbors, friends, family members, I could see them in a light separate from their crime. And I, in most cases, did not need to know their crime. However, most of them wanted to talk about it. But I could just meet them as students and treat them as such, and that made a lot of difference.
We're talking to Jan Walker about her experience teaching in prisons. Her new book is Unlocking Minds in Lockup, Prison Education Opens Doors. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been a part of this story as an inmate, an educator, a social worker, or a correctional officer? What do you see as the value of educational programs in prison? And what questions do you have for our guest about her experience? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation with Jan Walker, author of Unlocking Minds in Lockup. In the book, she tells the story of her 18 years as an educator in men's and women's prisons.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about what it was like to teach in prison? Or have you been a part of this as an inmate, a social worker, an educator, or a correctional officer? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers with Costa in Janesville. Costa, hi.
Hi there. How are you doing? I've been in corrections for 18 years. I've been a correctional officer, a guidance counselor at a prison school, and I'm now a probation agent altogether 18 years. And I would like to mention a phenomenon that I've noticed, which is when a parent becomes an inmate who used to be highly important on the family. He was the main breadwinner, etc. When he goes away, the rank in the family changes. The mother becomes the head of the family, and an older boy, for example, will become the man of the house. Hmm. When the inmate parent returns, the ranks are kind of shuffled all over. The woman goes from being an independent woman to being, again, second in command, I guess, to the main breadwinner, and the older boy might become third in rank. So I've seen a little conflict with the inmate parent returning and expecting everything to be the way it was before.
Very interesting, and Costa. Thank you so much. And Jan, is that something that you worked on inmates with, making that transition, re-entering a different family than they left, maybe, in a way?
Absolutely, because the family dynamics do change, and there will always be some level of conflict. There probably is what might be called a honeymoon period for most families when a parent goes home from prison. But one of the things I taught and wrote about in the parenting book that I have been keeping updated for the last 25 years or so, I have a section on contracts for forgiveness and work with parents who are preparing to go home to find ways to fit back into the family and to have realistic expectations. That one of who's really in charge and who can tell children what is expected of them is a very major problem. And so we did contracts in the classroom. I taught that. And then when I was volunteering inside, when we worked with families of inmates who came inside to work with their, in that case it was inmate daughter, we had them make contracts. So so that everyone sort of had an idea of where they stood from the beginning. An inmate parent cannot go home and assume that they're going to pick up where they left off. And children being children are going to rebel if a parent that has been away tries to tell them that they can or must do something or they cannot. It's just expected that the children will have some resistance. And so everyone has to work on how that is going to work. And I think contracts are absolutely essential. I know it sounds a little formal for family, but it's an important part of returning from being a distant parent to being, again, a hands-on parent.
Costa, thanks so much for bringing up that that issue. We'll go next to Elaine in Princeton. Elaine, hi.
Hi. I'm calling about there's a 65-year-old man. He's a family member, and he's in prison, and he has adult children. Now, when he gets released, he has nowhere to go. His family has completely cut him off. There isn't even any contact. Is there any way classes or something would help him to recommunicate with his children?
Elaine, thanks for that call. Jen, I know you may not be familiar with resources here in Wisconsin, but do you have advice for that situation, an older inmate estranged from adult children?
Well, I do believe that the incarcerated parent, regardless of age of the children, has to make the first move to try to reach out. If, in fact, the doors are closed and are not going to open, that person has to make other plans. And as you say, I don't know what's available in Wisconsin, but generally before anyone is released from a prison, their case management program inside prison will be working with them about where they're going to be released to. And in some cases, there may not be anyone that will take them. But generally, churches and other social organizations are available to help. I would also say that if a family has said absolutely no more, they want nothing to do with that person, the person may need to be working on the fact that that's reality, because sometimes the family on the outside have been hurt or burned so badly they are not willing to negotiate.
Elaine, thanks for that call, and good luck to you and your family. Jan, as we wrap up, you write also about the role of prison, and one of the roles being rehabilitation, which the education is part of. Do we not put enough emphasis, though, on rehabilitation in our correction system?
We have not for the last many years. Once the mandatory minimum and three strikes laws were enacted, most of the budget for offering programs, including educational programs and in some cases job skill building, disappeared from prisons, and people had more time to do nothing inside. And that's when a lot of complaints were being heard across the country about just men, especially just working out on the weight pile, building bigger muscles and becoming stronger and more likely to be harmful to someone when they got out. Right now, with this interest in criminal justice reform that starts with our president and spreads across the country, we need to also look at prison education reform, because it's a two-prong situation. Inmates, offenders need to have programming while they're inside to prepare them for when they're leaving, and that includes all sorts of education, because many of them go into prison at very low levels below fourth grade, but also there are many that go in with college educational backgrounds. And so we need a variety of programs available, and we need job skill training. And job skill training begins with offenders who have been doing a lot of time with simply learning how to be on time when they are involved in any kind of programming. But education is a major need inside prisons, and I believe that we're seeing it start to grow again, partly as a result of the RAND Corporation study that showed for every dollar spent inside on education, it saved $5 taxpayer dollars on recidivism costs. I'm hoping that some of the things I write about in Unlocking Minds and Lockup will give clues to other people to the kinds of programs that can be successful with inmate students, because they are interested in learning. And once they have an opportunity, most of them progress quite rapidly.
And we'll leave it there. Jan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Jan Walker. Her new book is Unlocking Minds in Lockup, Prison Education Opens Doors.
There have been a lot of reports lately showing Americans aren't saving enough for retirement. It's not just an issue for think tanks. It's also on the mind of the president and, increasingly, state officials. Shemaine Mills brings us part two of her series.
Sandy and Mike Lucier are retired, and Sandy says life is good. They saved for years while working.
We don't watch pennies or anything.
But Mike says they do make do with less. They got rid of one car, and now that the kids are gone, they've moved from a four-bedroom house in Milwaukee to a condominium in Madison.
It's a strategy of simplifying life now by downsizing to a condo-sized living.
So while some appear to be set, retirement for others looks bleak. It's such a pressing issue that President Barack Obama made it part of his 2014 State of the Union speech.
Today, most workers don't have a pension. A Social Security check often isn't enough on its own. And while the stock market has doubled over the last 5 years, that doesn't help folks who don't have 401ks.
During that speech, President Obama unveiled MyRA, a low-risk, low-fee individual retirement account. UW Madison Associate Professor J. Michael Collins calls MyRA an exciting proposal, although it does have limitations. It's capped at $15,000.
It allows people to at least get their foot in the door. You know, it's certainly not enough to retire on, but it's a way to, very low-cost way to save in general and specifically save for retirement.
Last spring, Collins and others examined MyRA and eight other retirement plans. Many are state-based.
What's fascinating about this topic is just that states are taking a lead. You know, you usually think about pensions and retirement as being either an employer or a federal role, and the fact that states are kind of stepping up and being innovative, and that, you know, Oregon and California and these other states are really pushing ahead to try to figure out a solution.
Wisconsin Democratic Senator Dave Hansen is also seeking a solution. His bill would create a private board that would come up with a private pension plan similar to the Wisconsin retirement system. Under the law, the private fund would be separate from the public fund. Introduced in two separate sessions, it hasn't gotten traction, even though Hansen says over 1 million workers in Wisconsin have no access to a retirement plan.
So we're figuring there's a real possibility of a train wreck in the future.
The bill would create a defined benefit plan. Nationally, only 1 in 5 private industry workers have this. Professor Collins explains why.
You know, companies couldn't afford to do that as workers worked for them for shorter periods and they lived longer. Those two things kind of collided, plus the ability to manage these funds and you know, make sure you had positive investment return every year was challenging. So more and more companies have gotten away from defined benefit, really kind of shifted the risk to the employees.
Companies have changed retirement plans over the years, and others don't offer them for workers like Chad Efron's.
It's not typical in the construction field to have a 401k or anything like that. Most of us are 1099 employees.
1099 refers to independent contractors. Retirement savings for the self-employed and low-income workers are of particular concern to policymakers. They worry about older Americans living in poverty during the so-called golden years. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.